Israeli troops attack a Palestinian sit-in outside a court in Jerusalem al-Quds to protest the planned evictions of families from their homes in Sidon district. The EU's rights agency warns that the coronavirus pandemic has had an unprecedented effect on human rights, fueling racism and child abuse. And also, India reports the world's highest single-day death toll from COVID-19 after a big eastern state revised its total coronavirus-related fatalities. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. In occupied Jerusalem, al-Quds Israeli forces have attacked Palestinians protesting against the regime's eviction plan in Jerusalem, al-Quds. The protesters were holding a sit-in outside an Israeli court which was hearing an appeal filed by two Palestinian families facing eviction from the Silwan neighborhood. Israeli forces reportedly arrested three protesters after beating them up. An Israeli court ruled in 2020 to forcibly evict seven Palestinian families in Silwan to pave the way for further settlement construction. The ruling is seen as part of the regime's land grab policy. In recent weeks, tensions have been running high in the occupied West Bank over Israel's eviction plans in several neighborhoods, including Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah. Palestinian activist Amal Wahdon says the Palestinian protests are a continuation of the demonstrations that started 6 weeks ago against the occupation in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem, al-Quds.
These protests actually is a continuation of the protests that started about 6 weeks ago back. And Jerusalemites, the Palestinian citizens of these homes, have decided that they're going to fight until the end. And the Israelis know this. So the protest is in line with the with the demonstrations and oppositions against even the court taking place, because these homes belong to the Palestinians for several years back. So the current escalation means that the Israelis are continuing to incite the Palestinians and pressure them to continue their policy of ethnic cleansing. It's a crime against international law and against the Geneva Convention, but the Israelis do not consider any of the regulations or laws by the UN or by the Geneva Convention.
Palestinian factions have slammed the Israeli regime for its latest onslaught in the occupied West Bank that left at least three people dead. In a statement, the Palestinian Authority warned that Israel's continued violation of rights would fuel more violence. Hamas and Fatah movements also condemned the raid and stressed the need for resistance against the regime's atrocities. Meanwhile, people took to the streets of the city of Jenin to express their anger at the overnight raid there. Two of those killed were intelligence officers from the Fatah movement, while the third victim was a member of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement. An Israeli soldier was killed, also reportedly killed in the exchange of fire. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details on the Israeli overnight raid in Jenin.
Well, what's known as the Yemen border police counter-terrorism, this is what is called by the Israeli authorities, raided Jenin in order to conduct arrest campaign, in order to arrest Palestinians known for being wanted for security reasons. This means that those Palestinians are engaged in anti-Israel operations or activities or anything against the Israeli occupation. Our sources there said the Israeli forces took with them a Palestinian vehicle, and inside it there was Palestinians. Later, it was revealed that one of the Palestinians who were wanted by the Israelis succumbed to his injuries, and he is Jamil Al-Amouri. He was a Palestinian activist belonging to Saraya Al-Quds from the Jihad movement. However, there are reports saying another Palestinian from the Jihad movement had been arrested during the operation, and we are speaking about a third Palestinian officer who is still in hospital in very serious conditions. Today, the funeral of those Palestinians would be taking place in Jenin. However, the funeral of the third Palestinian, of course, cannot take place as the Israeli forces would remain keeping the body of the Palestinian from the Jihad movement.
The European Union's rights agency says the coronavirus pandemic has had an unprecedented and profound effect on human rights, calling for action by European countries. In its annual report, the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights says the pandemic and its reactions have exacerbated the challenges and inequalities, especially affecting vulnerable groups. The report says the racist and xenophobic incidents have increased since the past year, targeting migrants and refugees. These groups are said to be at higher risk of contamination. The report also highlights a rise in domestic violence and sexual abuse, including online child abuse. In 2020, the Vienna-based agency has urged countries to take measures to tackle the pandemic and its challenges to human rights. The report covers 27 EU members as well as North Macedonia and Serbia. India has reported the world's highest daily coronavirus death toll with 6,148 fatalities in the past 24 hours. The record deaths push India's confirmed fatalities to nearly 360,000. That after the state of Bihar revised its tally, adding 4,000 more deaths. The country's health ministry has also announced over 94,000 new COVID cases. With that, the total caseload in India surges past 29 million. India has been struggling with an aggressive new wave of COVID-19 for the past 2 months. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the coronavirus surge, but the South Asian country remains the second worst affected in the world after the United States in terms of infections. Our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman says a severe shortage of coronavirus vaccines is India's biggest challenge these days.
The country has reported around 6,200 deaths, which is something highest the country has ever recorded. So yes, that's the area of concern. That's the biggest concern that is always there, because we in India, they want to make sure that the death toll remains as low as they can. But as we know, that the problem is with the healthcare facilities, there were oxygen problems, and of course the ventilator problems, the vaccination shortage. But in a lump sum, yes, there seems to be on ground, there seems to be a drastic change. The country has started unlocking in several states. Several states have announced the unlocking procedure with guidelines as well. They're not opening up instantly. They have started opening up in phases to make sure that they keep the COVID pandemic in check. Now, the biggest challenge that the country is facing right now is vaccinating its people. When the country is facing a huge shortage of vaccine, and the government is aiming at opening up vaccination program from the June 21, in which they have set targets to vaccinate every citizen above the age of 18. But many experts believe that this is going to be a phenomenal and a tremendous task for the country, because there is a lot of shortage of vaccination and the country's population is also massive.
Indigenous survivors of Canada's residential school system are recounting their sufferings following the recent recovery of the remains of hundreds of children at a former Catholic school.
Because I was young, so I got tortured, I got beaten up, and you name it, as a young child by the older group. Not only the boys amongst our group, but also the people that ran this center. This residence school.
It was the food, I still think about it. The food that they gave us, I was used to having rabbit and deer meat and potatoes and things like that. And with the food that we had there, I used to throw up, and my cousin would throw up too, and then they'd make us eat our vomit. and for many years, and I still have ulcers because of that.
A radar survey last month uncovered evidence of the remains of 215 children buried on the grounds of Kamloops Indian Residential School in the province of British Columbia. The residential school system, which operated between 1831 and 1996, separated about 150,000 Indigenous children from their families and sent them to Christian schools run on behalf of the federal government. The residential school system for Indigenous children came under a government policy later denounced as cultural genocide. The U.S. president has warned Russia about, quote, robust and meaningful consequences if Moscow engages in what he described as harmful activities. During our news review, we discussed about Joe Biden's latest anti-Russia rhetoric with our guests. Let's take a listen. On this edition, the U.S. president warns Russia it would face, quote, robust and meaningful consequences if Moscow engages in what he described as harmful activities.
This is my first overseas trip as President of the United States. I'm heading to the G7, then to the NATO ministerial, and then to meet with Mr. Putin to let him know what I want him to know. And at every point along the way, we're going to make it clear that the United States is back. And democracies of the world are standing together to tackle the toughest challenges and the issues that matter most to our future. That we're committed to leading with strength.
Joe Biden was speaking at a British airbase housing U.S. troops. He did not reveal the nature of Russia's perceived harmful activities. But Washington has blamed Russia for alleged interferences in past U.S. elections. Washington also claims a number of recent ransomware attacks targeting the U.S. emanate from Russia. Biden said the U.S. is not seeking conflict with Russia, adding that Washington wants a stable and predictable relationship. He noted that the U.S.'s commitment to NATO is rock solid, but said the alliance needs to modernize and expand its cyber capabilities. Biden will meet Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva next week. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political commentator Fred Weir, who's joining us from Moscow. Also, we have author and commentator John Stepling, who's with us from Inderøy, Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Fred Weir in Moscow. Joe Biden said Russia would face robust and meaningful consequences if Moscow engages in what he described as harmful activities. That's as vague and as ambiguous as a comment could get. Help us unpack what the U.S. president said.
This is absolutely familiar, too. Both leaders are out there shoveling these kind of statements about how Putin is all about the red lines yesterday. And I think this is mostly for domestic consumption before the summit, that they are both very, very eager to avoid the kind of fiasco that occurred in Helsinki 3 years ago, where Donald Trump was perceived as a Russian stooge and Putin got humiliated by the circus that took place in the media. They don't want that to happen again. I'm pretty sure this is a well-prepared summit that the experts have met. They've developed an agenda. They're playing it pretty close to the vest, so we don't know exactly what that will be. Probably there'll be talk of human rights and red lines and whatnot, but mainly one thinks it's about strategic stability, getting this spiral disintegration under control. I mean, it is a sobering thought that relations today are worse than they were at the worst moments of the Cold War. The back channels hardly exist. There's been virtually no dialogue, and the embassies on both sides are gutted. This is just insane. It can't go on. And so I think that their idea will be to impose some sort of management, at least on the process. They'll keep accusing each other of all the sins in the world. The confrontation will go on. The real geopolitical issues are there to still be solved if they can. But this kind of completely unpredictable chaos hopefully will end.
John Stepling, how do you perceive the recent comments coming from Joe Biden?
Well, certainly vague would be an understatement. It's actually almost amusing, whatever he might have meant by harmful activities. But we have been subjected to about 6 years or so of intense Russophobic propaganda coming out of the United States from mainstream media, from the government, the State Department, from everybody, from the think tanks, places like Brookings and Cato Institute and so forth. And the media has manufactured a series of narratives all the way back to the Skirpal poisonings in Salisbury to the depiction of Alexei Navalny as some radical freedom fighter. And on and on. I mean, the list is long, and it even preceded that, of course. There's always been a decided anti-Russian bent to much of the U.S. government. And the Biden administration, he stocked his administration with Russophobes and liberal interventionists. And a lot of the people that were involved in the 2014 coup in Ukraine. So, this is the policy of the U.S. rarely changes. It's foreign policy, and it hasn't with Biden. It's not going to with Biden. You'll notice that, in spite of a different style, he's really just continuing Trump's policies.
Joining us from Moscow, so thanks to author and commentator John Stepling, speaking to us from Android. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In this day and age where videos of U.S. allies committing war crimes are readily available on Twitter or Instagram, no one can claim they don't know what U.S.-made weapons are used for around the world, says Danaka Ketovich, author in an article titled Arms Sales, What Americans Know About Bombs Being Dropped in Their Name. Stay tuned for more. At some point before the summer of 2018, an arms deal from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia was sealed and delivered. A 227-kilogram laser-guided bomb made by Lockheed Martin, one of many thousands, was part of that sale. On August 9, 2018, one of those Lockheed Martin bombs was dropped on a school bus full of Yemeni children. They were on their way to a field trip when their lives came to a sudden end. Amidst shock and grief, their loved ones would learn that Lockheed Martin was responsible for creating the bomb that murdered their children. What they might not know is that the United States government, the president, and the State Department approved the sale of the bomb that killed their children, in the process enriching Lockheed Martin, which makes millions in profits from arms sales every year. While Lockheed Martin profited from the death of 40 Yemeni children that day, top United States weapons companies continue to sell weapons to repressive regimes around the world, killing countless more people in Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and more. Now, the U.S. $735 million in precision-guided weapons that are being sold to the Israeli regime are destined to have a similar fate. The news about this sale broke in the midst of the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza that killed over 200 Palestinians. When the Zionist regime attacks Gaza, it does so with U.S.-made bombs and warplanes. If we condemn the abhorrent destruction of life that occurs when Saudi Arabia or the Israeli regime kills people with U.S.-manufactured weapons, what can we do about it? Arms sales are confusing. Every once in a while, a news story will break about a certain weapon sale from the U.S. to some other countries across the globe that is worth millions or even billions of dollars. And Americans virtually have no say in where the bombs that say made in the USA go. By the time they hear about a sale, the export licenses are already approved and Boeing factories are churning out weapons we've never even heard of. Even for people who consider themselves well informed about the military-industrial complex, find themselves getting lost in the web of procedure and timing of weapon sales. There is a gross lack of transparency and information made available to the American people. Generally, here's how arms sales work. There is a period of negotiation that takes place between a country that wants to buy weapons and either the U.S. government or a private company like Boeing or Lockheed Martin. After a deal is reached, the State Department is required by the Arms Export Control Act to notify Congress. After the notification is received by Congress, they have 15 or 30 days to introduce and pass a resolution of joint disapproval to block the issuance of the export license. The amount of days depends on how close the United States is with the country buying the weapons. According to the U.S. law, the United States should not be sending weapons to regimes like Israel and Saudi Arabia, among others. Technically, doing so goes against the Foreign Assistance Act, which is one of the main laws governing weapon sales. Section 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act says that weapons sold by the United States cannot be used for human rights violations. When Saudi Arabia dropped that Lockheed Martin bomb on those Yemeni kids, no argument could be made for legitimate self-defense. When the primary target of Saudi airstrikes in Yemen are weddings, funerals, schools, and residential neighborhoods in Sana'a, the United States has no legitimate justification for their use of U.S.-manufactured weapons. When the Israeli regime uses Boeing Joint Direct Attack munitions to level residential buildings and international media sites, they are not doing so out of legitimate self-defense. In this day and age, where videos of U.S. allies committing war crimes are readily available on Twitter or Instagram, no one can claim that they don't know what U.S.-made weapons are used for around the world. Are Americans willing to put their efforts into changing the procedure of arms sales to include more transparency and accountability? Are they willing to invoke their own laws? More importantly, are they willing to put their efforts into drastically changing their economy so that Yemeni and Palestinian parents who put every ounce of love into raising their children do not have to live in fear that their whole world could be taken in an instant? As it stands, U.S. economy benefits from selling tools of destruction to other countries. That is something Americans must realize and ask if there is a better way to be a part of the world. The next steps for people who are concerned about this U.S. arms sales to the Israeli regime should be petitioning the State Department and asking their members of Congress to introduce legislation to block the sale.
In that permission, Shahid said, after praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says that our respectable son, Hujjatul Islam wal Muslimin, Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi, has spent a long time of his life learning fiqh, usul, and theological studies, so that he has succeeded to become a mujtahid on whom Islam and the Muslims may rely.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was living in Najaf. This was because, I mean, the ex-Baathist regime hadn't devastated the whole Najaf seminary. And another one is that Najaf was in some way the hub of all the Shiite world.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio. This is the teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. For today's discussion, we want to continue our discussion regarding the character of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi Shahrudi. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom, and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So in a previous discussion, we talked about the biography of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi Shahrudi. Today, let's talk a little bit about his scientific activities, Sayyid Mohsen. You know, and we know that the scientific activities of Ayatollah Shahrudi are overshadowed by his political ones, both in Iran and in Iraq. Talk a little bit about the scientific character and the scholarly character of this man for us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Ayatollah Shahrudi was the student of three most prominent scholars and the mujtahid, we can say, marja, of their own time: Ayatollah Khoi, Imam Khomeini, and Shahid Sadr. And as you know, that Ayatollah Shahrudi has got his the permission of ijtihad by Shaheed Sadr. Okay. And in that permission, Shaheed Sadr, after praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says that our respectable son, Hujjatul Islam wal Muslimin, Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi, has spent a long time of his life learning fiqh, usul, and theological studies. Allah has confirmed that and blessed him so that he has succeeded to become a mujtahid on whom Islam and the Muslims may rely. These are the wordings of Shaykh Sadr.
These are the written ijazah?
Yes, it's a written ijazah. It's the translation of the Arabic phrases that I have, which he wrote on 7th of Rabiul Thani, 1399 AH.
And is this in the handwriting of...
Yes, it's the handwriting.
Do you have it? Do you have it over there?
I got the picture of the Muhammad Baqir Sadr's signature and writings
okay.
here.
Okay, and his own and handwriting.
The ijtihad is, yes, the permission that he gave. And the point is, like, he says, like, I authorized him to arrange all the religious bindings affairs, and his ideas is the same as mine. Okay. And all the believers, my followers and the authorized ones, are allowed to give him the religious tax which they are giving to me. Mm-hmm. And then he asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help him. So this was the small text of permission that he gave, the permission of ijtihad.
So I think, and he was very much young at that time,
He was very much young. Okay. And in this statement, you know, generally when they give the mujtahideen, when they give the permission of the ijtihad, they say, like, this person has the ability to, you know, bring the discussion or give the fatwa and can give their opinion.
That's right.
In this ijazah, which I'm just looking at and I'm just reading the translation, he says that I authorized him to arrange all the religious bindings affairs, and his ideas is same as mine. Mm-hmm. And this is very important. As a teacher, when he's giving a ijazah, thinking that this person has the same idea as mine and he is the true representative of what I want to convey and what I want to say.
That's all right.
So this is the first thing. And after that, obviously, Shaheed Sadr has written many books. His one of the famous book is on the Usul al-Fiqh, which is the interpretation, we can say, of the halaqat of Shaheed Sadr.
You mean Ayatollah Shahridi wrote this book?
Seven volume book, which is the interpretation of the lectures of Usul, which Shaheed Sadr had on halaqat.
Okay.
You know, we discussed, I think, in the program of Shaheed Sadr, yes, that he had the three books of the Usul, which is written in a new way.
That's right.
So he has written them, and even on top of that, like Shaheed Sadr also has commented on those seven volumes.
Oh.
And he expressed his feelings about it, and that's, he wrote, right, like, I've seen the most best explanation about what I was explaining, and he just explained it in a better ways, and
that's all
these
right
are the wordings that we have about.
Very good, very great. You know, that's all right. Very much great. Okay, Dr. Fakhrani, how did you find the academic and the scholarly character of Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi Sharidi? Explain a little bit for us.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Regarding the academic character and the academic and the scholarly character of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi, it must be indicated that, as our dear friend and brother Sayyid Naqvi indicated, the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi explicated some of the seminal texts that his teacher, the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Sadr, had written. And this is a great academic, great and praiseworthy academic tradition, mainly in Islamic and most particularly in Shia world, that, for example, when a prominent Ayatollah writes a seminal text, his immediate students and disciples come to explicate it, and explain it in a more clear way for the posterity.
That's right.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late of the time when the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Sadr and subsequently the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was living in, they were living in Najaf. One of the great benefits of the Najaf seminary at that time was that, first of all, it's regarded as the golden period of the Najaf seminary. This was because, I mean, the ex-Baathist regime hadn't devastated the whole Najaf seminary.
Okay.
This is number one. And another one is that Najaf was in some way the hub of all the Shiite world. Okay, for example, at that time in Najaf, there were great scholars from Bahrain, from Iran, from Pakistan,
That's
India,
right.
Lebanon, Syria, and everywhere. And not only the late Sheikh Sayyid Muhammad Baghdad Sadr, but also many of his students were also very active. So you find that in the circle, in the academic circle, in the close, an immediate academic circle of the late Sheikh Sayyid Muhammad Baghdad Sadr, you can find many students from Iran, from Bahrain, from Lebanon, from India, That's from right. Pakistan, from Afghanistan. Not only all of them benefited from the late Sheikh Sayyid Muhammad Baghdad Sadr, but also these great brains
That's
collaborated
right.
with each other and enriched each other's minds. And
That's
this
right.
was one of the great benefits of the close academic circle that the late Sheikh Sayyid Muhammad Baghdad Sadr created in Najaf.
That's all right.
I should like to add another point, and the point is that the late Sheikh Sayyid Muhammad Baghdad Sadr encourages students, for example, his originally Iranian students, to be in contact both with Iran and with Lebanon.
That's right.
Why with Lebanon? Or why with Egypt? Because, I mean, they were great centers. I mean, Lebanon and Egypt
right.
were great centers for publishing Islamic thought. I mean, books on Islamic thought in Arabic.
That's all right.
And this mutually, I mean, enriched the minds of these young scholars and enriched the world of scholarship.
That's all right. Yes. Including Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi.
Yes.
Any more comments on his academic life, brother?
Yeah, in his academic life, we can see, like, he started teaching in Najaf.
Mm-hmm.
And because Shahid Sadr's father was the in charge, and we can say like the principal of the whole Hawza of Najaf. After that, Shahid Sadr also had the same duty in his hands.
That's right.
He made him the exam controller
mm-hmm.
in the Najaf seminary. So he was one of the he was the head of the examination controlling in Najaf. And since he had many students, and he has obviously taught many people, today we can see many great scholars being his students. Like the great scholars
That's
which
right.
we know, or
okay.
the personalities.
Yes.
Maybe they are the political, they are the philosophical or Islamic.
Okay.
For example, I can just name some of them. Sheikh Mohsen Araki, a well-known person.
These are the students of whom?
Students of late Ayatollah Shahroudi. So basically, from the students of Ayatollah Shahroudi, we can count, for example, Sheikh Mohsen Araki was one of his students.
Hmm.
And there are many names, for example, Ahmed Abu Zayd Al-Amili. These are the prominent people who are well known in the Hawza especially.
That's right.
And we had, for example, like from Hakim family, there were some of his students. Sheikh Isa Qasim Al-Bahrani is also his students. But Sheikh Baqir Irwani, one of the prominent people in the Hawza of Najaf in today's time.
Okay.
At the current time, if you go to the Hawza of Najaf and if you want to see a scholar who has most of the students and who is talking on the fiqh and usul, who has like a great grip on these two subjects, at the moment in the Hawza of Najaf, it's Baqir Irwani,
oh.
who have written, for example, many books as well. And even in Qom, Hawza of Qom and Najaf, in both Hawzas, today they are teaching his books. For example, before they used to teach Sharh al-Lum'ah,
yes.
which was from Shahid Thani.
Yes.
But today, the book which has obviously replaced Sharh al-Lum'ah is the Durus al-Tamhidiyya
right.
fil Fiqh
That's
of
right.
Baqir Irwani.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, he has the same books in the Usul as well. Durus al-Usul, he has those ones which are obviously covering. And they are also some kind of explanation of, we can say, like the lectures of Shahid Sadr, which was.
And Baghir Irwani is the student of Ayatollah Shahroudi?
Yes.
Okay.
He is the student of Ayatollah Shahroudi.
Mm-hmm.
We can see the name of Shahid Sayyid Abbas Musavi,
mm-hmm.
who was the General Secretary of
yes.
Lebanon.
Yes.
The current General Secretary of Lebanon, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah.
Yes.
is also one of the students
okay.
of late
Shahroudi,
Ayatollah Shahroudi.
Right. Okay.
And there are many other names, almost we can see from the prominent, there are 110 students,
okay.
which are the prominent, we can say, face or personalities of today's world,
mm-hmm.
at the current time where we are living.
Right.
And most of them are from, like, they are there at the moment in the Qom or Najaf, and obviously in Tehran as well.
That's all
so,
right.
So Hassan Ja'farzadeh, mm-hmm. he's in Tehran. He's one of his prominent students. Yes. So basically, he had his academic life as well as the other activities he had.
Yes.
So, you know, a personality who can manage, that's another point of his life.
Yes.
That he could manage all these things together. Mm-hmm. All these things. And the relation that he had with his students was taken from his teacher. Because Ayatollah Shahrudi used to talk about his teacher, Shahid Sadr, the way he that's used to deal with his students. Similarly, those who went to his lectures, Ayatollah Shahrudi's, they have seen that he personally used to, you know, give some time to each and every single student who was going to his lectures. And he was very attentive towards them.
Yes.
He used to check their notes as well, mm-hmm. commenting on the notes while he had, you know, many other, we can say, like, responsibilities, especially when he was in Iran.
That's all right.
And he had his political,
He was the head of judiciary in Islamic. And the new look that he had at the judicial system started by him, I think, in Iran. Also, he was selected as the head of the Islamic Fiqh Encyclopedia or Encyclopedia of the Islamic Fiqh by the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. This shows how much, you know, these great positions and the contributions and the consultations that he was giving to the leader and the other, you know, academic scholars in Iran were great, a part of the scholarly life of the late Ayatollah Uzma Hashemi Shahrudi. Okay, anything missed? No, nothing about his academic life, Sayyid Mohsen?
Yes. Another point is, like, you know, he was a link between Shahid Sadr and Imam Khomeini mm-hmm. at the time when he was. First, it was Ahmad Khomeini, the late son of Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
And then when he was stopped, like, from moving between Iraq and Iran, and he was with his father, Imam Khomeini, then Ayatollah Shahrudi basically become a link.
Oh.
And you know that Shahid Sadr has made, you know, a group against the Ba'ath regime.
That's right.
So he was the representative, and after Shahid Sadr, he became the leader of that party.
Political activities political against activities, the Ba'ath regime in Iraq. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Dr. Mohammad Reza Fakhrohani, for a presence in this program. That is the teacher. I'm Atal, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
A teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
New data released on Monday, June 7th, showed atmospheric carbon dioxide reached a monthly average level of 419 parts per million in May, which is not only the maximum reading ever recorded since accurate measurements began 63 years ago, but also the highest level the planet has experienced in over 4 million years. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Atmospheric Carbon Dioxide Hits Highest Level in Over 4 Million Years. Here's the details. New data released on Monday, June 7th, showed atmospheric carbon dioxide reached a monthly average level of 419 parts per million in May, which is not only the maximum reading ever recorded since accurate measurements began 63 years ago, but also the highest level the planet has experienced in over 4 million years. Scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, and Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, working at NOAA's Mauna Loa Atmospheric Baseline Observatory in Hawaii, said the May measurements, an increase from 417 parts per million in May 2020, mean that the atmospheric burden of CO2 is now comparable to where it was during the Paleocene climatic optimum between 4.1 and 4.5 million years ago, when CO2 was close to or above 400 ppm. During that time, sea level was about 78 feet higher than today. The average temperature was 7 degrees Fahrenheit higher than in pre-industrial times, and studies indicate large forest-occupied areas of the Arctic that are now tundra, they said. The scientists noted that while the worldwide economic slowdown during the coronavirus pandemic led to a significant but temporary decrease in global greenhouse gas emissions, the drop had no discernible impact on the rate of atmospheric CO2 accumulation. As Common Dreams reported recently, atmospheric CO2 concentrations surged past 420 ppm for the first time in recorded history in April. Ralph Keeling, the geochemist in charge of Scripps Mauna Loa program, said that the ultimate control knob on atmospheric CO2 is fossil fuel emissions, and that we still have a long way to go to halt the rise as each year more CO2 piles up in the atmosphere. We ultimately need cuts that are much larger and sustained longer than the COVID-related shutdowns of 2020, he added. Peter Tenz, a senior scientist at NOAA's Global Monitoring Lab, noted that CO2 is stored in the Earth's oceans and atmosphere for thousands of years after it is emitted. We are adding roughly 40 billion metric tons of CO2 pollution to the atmosphere per year, Tenz said in a statement announcing the new figures. That is a mountain of carbon that we dig up out of the earth, burn, and release into the atmosphere as CO2, year after year. If we want to avoid catastrophic climate change, the highest priority must be to reduce CO2 pollution to zero at the highest possible date, stress tense. Thank you. such a reduction would require a dramatic shift in human activity, especially by the world's wealthiest 1%, who, according to a September 2020 study by Oxfam, emit more than twice as much CO2 as the poorest 50% of humanity. The solution is right before our eyes, said Tense. Solar energy and wind are already cheaper than fossil fuels, and they work at the scales that are required. If we take real action soon, we might still be able to avoid catastrophic climate change. The new figures come as world leaders and policy makers prepare for the upcoming United Nations Climate Change Conference, also known as COP26, which will be held in Glasgow, Scotland this November. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more.
no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In continuing our discussion on the very beautiful tradition of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, on defining and describing that person who is aqil and that person who is jahil, we have reached this segment of the tradition where the Imam alayhi salam again mentions two characteristics, and by now you should be aware, one for the aql and one as a unit for the aql and one as a unit for the jahil. So here that particular unit or characteristic that is mentioned for an aqil is what is known as al-amana, and obviously that which has been mentioned as the unit for the jahal is al-khiyana. So here al-amana, or what can be explained as trustworthiness, and that's the way we see that the Holy Prophet was known as al-amin, that when something is given to you, when something is trusted upon you, wherever that thing may be, again, as we mentioned, there are many different instances, references here. One, for example, could be a basic, amount of physical money. Other things could be, more worthy, even if more expensive than money. For example, if someone tells you a particular secret, not about a bad thing, like, for example, he knows that he wants to do something and he has a means to do it, then you go and tell that to somebody else who is in direct competition with him, for example. This is something bad, that you have broken a promise. You have done, treachery, and you have been irresponsible with that particular thing that you have been given. And there's many other things. For example, the physical one that I want to give is someone gives you some money to keep, and you do khiyana to that money. You spend it, and you don't tell him. That person forgets, you don't remind him. Just because he forgets does not mean the money becomes yours. No, you have to return it. The trust means that, that particular thing that was given to you and you accepted it, you cannot use it without the permission of that particular person. This is something important to know. If, for example, again, this is a fiqh discussion, we don't want to get into it, but if a person does have to use it in a particular time, he has to seek the permission of the owner. You cannot just, because, it's in my possession, it's in my home, it's in my safe, I have... No, you don't. That is also khiyana to that particular trust. It's also, being irresponsible with it. You are being very treacherous with that particular thing that you have been given. At the end of the day, that amana that has been given to you, is extremely... Rather, you are responsible for it and you have to be answerable for it. But there is a more deeper explanation of this tradition, and that is the amana of Islam and belief. That you have been given this amana and this belief, and then you have to protect it. You have to obey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You have to be a good person. And if you don't, you're awfully doing khiyana to that belief, to that responsibility and that gift and trust that Allah has given you as a Muslim, and especially as a Shia of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make us ameen with this belief and this righteousness and this haqq that we have, insha'Allah ta'ala. Until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Your door, send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be